Coffee Podcast, episode 12. We are finishing up our conversation about green coffee sourcing, having talked about directly sourcing your coffee through farm to coffee roaster relationships. Talked about that last week. This week we're going to talk about a slightly easier way to do it, and not better, not worse, just different, and certainly really helps a lot of coffee roasters get started, and that's working with importers.
Majority of people work through importers. The minority is for sure doing direct because it's a lot more work involved.
For a small roaster getting started doing direct sourcing, they're probably working a lot with importers too, right?
That's right. And if you're a small roasting operation, it really doesn't pay to go direct. Like, you might love the idea of working directly with a farmer, but it's really, like, if you're only getting a couple bags of coffee, it's really expensive to import just those couple bags of coffee. I was chatting with a small roaster out of Chicago, and he was telling me how when they buy just, like, 10 bags, like, oh, yeah, we just air freight it, and that's, like, $5 a pound. Ridiculous prices for, like, we wouldn't be able to survive at Stone Creek right. If we air freighted everything in. Like, the only reason we're able to do direct trade is because we're able to take in a large amount of coffee at a given time, so we actually get a more reasonable price. And that's where an importer can kind of come in and save you from that, because they buy a lot of coffee, and you can just buy from them the coffee, little by little, what you want.
To kind of outline then the process of working with an importer, because we talked about direct relationships and provided a summary of what all goes into that, but do the farm-to-cup thing with an importer.
Yeah.
So outline for us exactly what it looks like to work with an importer to get your green coffee.
The first and foremost thing to do is to make sure you're working with the right importer, and this is going to take a little bit of time to get used to. And it's starting a new relationship with anyone. You want to make sure that your values align, because there are a lot of different kinds of importers out there. Some who deal in really high-end boutique coffee, others that deal in commodity and just above commodity style coffee. And all of that coffee has a home somewhere for a roaster that fits. But you want to make sure that you align up. So you introduce yourself, say, hey, I am so-and-so, and I'm interested in doing coffee from, say, Africa and Central America, and looking for coffees that are Q8284. What do you have in stock that fits my price range? And they come back and they say, hey, yeah, we do this, we do this, we do this. And you can kind of get a sense for, is this going to match up? Is this going to work? And then the next important thing to do is to verify that you're actually... We have this saying at Stone Creek, it's trust but verify. And so you can trust that, yeah, we have the same values, but you verify it by tasting the coffees and saying, yeah, this actually does line up with what you say. Yeah, I guess this is a good relationship for us. I can trust you. And eventually you start to develop a kind of a dialogue between what coffees you're looking for. And if you get to know an importer really well, they can start advocating for you ahead of time.
Getting what you would want from origin.
Getting what you'd want from origin, and even like looking out for you when things hit the cupping table. They'll give you a call and say, hey, I just had this coffee. This fits your spec. I'm going to hold it off for you. You should cup it out. You know, we'll just keep it around here. Let me know if you want it.
So if you're a starting roaster, and I know a guy actually out near Tampa, Florida, who's starting a roasting operation. He was in a band for a long time and has started his own thing. And for him, it's just the greatest thing in the world to work with importers, because he only runs right now probably two coffees at a time. He buys five bags of each of those coffees, and he's set for a while through e-commerce and the wholesale accounts he has right now. It's when you start getting into bigger and bigger quantities that it gets a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, you have to plan well, and you have to know what coffees an importer has available at any given time. This is something that a green buyer eventually starts to learn, like when is your Central America's available, when are Africa's available. You also have to figure out how much you need, because once an importer's out, they're out for the year. Like, they're not going to be able to find it. They may be able to pull something together from origin if there's enough quantity, but you have to plan accordingly, and once they're out, you're out of luck, and you have to try to find something that might not match the spec that you're looking for. And I had a lot of dealing with this my first year as the director of coffee, because we didn't have a lot of farm-to-cup relationships, a lot of direct relationships. And so it was trying to, like, okay, here's what you call spot purchasing. So what an importer has at a warehouse. Oh, you sold out of that? Well, let's try this. Let's try this. Let's try this. And eventually you get a rhythm. You develop that relationship, but it can be pretty tough the first year. The other thing that's kind of an important thing to think about if you're a coffee roaster on the East Coast or West Coast is to look and see what kind of warehousing an importer has. Like, you might fall in love with an importer that is only on the West Coast. And if you're in New York, you're probably not going to want to pull coffee out of Portland or Seattle or San Francisco because it's going to cost a lot more money to move that coffee across the United States than it would be to pull coffee out of someone like New Jersey or Charleston, South Carolina.
So if you're just doing smaller purchases, it actually won't work out too bad for you if you sort of have the company structure to highlight a single origin coffee. Where you can get in trouble is if you're building coffee blends out of these and then the importer were to run out, that can really alter sort of the components of your blend and then deliver a different experience to the customer. For better or worse, oftentimes if you're messing with the taste profile of a blend that you've gotten in the habit of offering and they've gotten in the habit of liking, they're just not going to like the change because they liked what you initially gave them.
Oh, customers hate change. And
not
it's not a bad thing, but it's true. Like, customers just get so used to a habit. Like, if you go to your favorite restaurant and all of a sudden they change the menu, you'd be like, what's going on here? Like, you just changed something that I love. And it might be a good change. It might be a bad change. It's just something different, but it shocks you to the point of where you're like, you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, and in general, I think the specialty coffee industry isn't super understanding of customers not liking change. A lot of us really are foodies, and we like to try different beers and different whiskeys, different foods. So to have a different coffee is not a big deal, but the general public isn't. They may not be as adventurous. So if we just hate on them for loving the same thing, we may be doing ourselves a disservice. And I think that happens a lot, actually.
I would agree with that, and that's something that I had to learn the hard way, angry customer emails when I changed something. And like Drew said, I'm really interested. Like, I don't want to eat the same breakfast 2 days in a row. I want to try new and interesting things that are out there, but I'm probably one of a minority. And a lot of you will probably say, oh yeah, I like trying new things. But if you think about that thing that really makes an impact in your daily routine, like if you are a drip coffee or you're a mocha person, you go to your cafe every single day, you want it to taste the same day in and day out. And if someone goes and messes with your stuff, like, you're going to be upset. I get it.
Different size coffee roasters will work with importers for different reasons. So we already mentioned sort of a micro roaster. It's just the easiest way for them to get the amount of coffee they need. And due to the quality of importers that are out there, they can get whatever quality they need. And can normally hit the price point. Let's move from there and talk about how Stone Creek Coffee uses importers, because we really value sort of the farm-to-cup method of working with coffee. We go and we meet as many farmers as we can, and we try and develop these relationships that are going to help us get the coffee that we want and do it in a manner that's sustainable and matches with our values. But we still use importers occasionally.
Yeah, absolutely. We just need to find importers that match our value set. They pretty much will work the same way that we do, but they might work in different regions. They might work in Africa. We don't have a lot of strength in Africa yet. They might work in Indonesia. They might be in a country in Central America that we haven't traveled in. And if they treat their partners at origin the same way that we do, and I see that they value the same things in cup quality that we do, and they have the same kind of transparency that we do, then it's a perfect fit. And it's really easy to work with them. And I typically use importers to find, like, unique one-off lots. And I have a couple people, they'll send me something. If it's really good, I'll be like, okay, get them on the phone. Let's book this right now. And I sometimes use it as a backup plan in case something goes wrong with one of my direct trade, or like it doesn't cup out or something went wrong along the way. So I always have a solid backup plan there. But it's primarily to find origins that I don't have access to otherwise. And a long time, like if we start to really fall in love with that coffee, we want to try to develop a more direct relationship. We might still use the importer to bring it in. And we have a couple contacts in Nicaragua. We use Royal Coffee out of San Francisco to bring in that coffee because I have a strong relationship with this farm. We've gone down and visited, but it's just easier for us to move a partial container through the importer than it is for us to just, you know, pay the extra money to get the couple bags exported here.
There are even a few other models where roasters even the size of Stone Creek will elect to work primarily with coffee importers.
Yeah, I've heard of some. It was pretty amusing. Like, I heard a story of a West Coast roaster. I heard that they were, like, clogging up one of the major importers' warehouses, and they were, like, incurring finance charges because every month that you hold coffee at an importer's warehouse, it's a 2 cent charge on top of the coffee, 2 cents charge on top of the coffee. And they had, like, half of the warehouse with their coffee just kind of sitting there. And they're like, what are you guys going to move it? No, we're just going to leave it down there. We're not ready for it yet. Like, you guys, you got to get it out of here. And kind of people abusing the privileges of a bigger importer like that. But, yeah, you can definitely source all your coffee through that. And I'll take a step back and say that not everyone uses importers to get the best coffee possible. And in the same fashion, not everyone uses direct trade to get the best quality possible. What they're looking for is coffee that fits their means. And just because someone puts, like, specialty coffee high-end doesn't mean it actually will be specialty coffee high-end. What it means is that it fits their spec, and you, the customer, is the one that's going to be able to make the judgment statement on whether they're hitting that goal and whether you like it. Because you can get coffee from an importer that's amazing, you can get coffee from an importer that sucks. Same way you can get coffee directly that's amazing, and you can also get coffee directly that's terrible.
Mm. As you sort of look at sourcing models, you can even look in cities, and I think of Milwaukee because we're in Milwaukee, and there are a lot of roasters here, and the green coffee sourcing models for each roaster, I know a little bit about them, are all very different, and as Christian said, sort of match the mission of the particular roaster. I won't presume to outline everybody's philosophy, but it's just super unique to see how each coffee company handles their sourcing a little bit differently.
It is super interesting because if you are, let's say, if you value fair trade organics or if you value certain regions, like, you're going to go after certain things, and it might be easier for you to work with an importer or one importer over another importer if you're looking for something in particular. And there's really no right or wrong way to do it, so long as you're getting what you need to survive as your company. And it might not be what we agree with, but there's obviously a home for any coffee that's out there. And however you get there, you know, good for you. And you, the customer, can kind of make the decision on whose mission you want to back.
As with direct trade, there are definitely risks of sourcing coffee through importers. With direct trade, a problem you can run into is you cup something in origin. Even your pre-ship samples that they send you to taste good, and then something goes wrong in shipment or with a lot of the lots in the coffee you ordered, and you end up with bad coffee. That's a risk. There are also risks associated with sourcing coffee through importers. And what I'll let Christian kind of outline this, but one thing I've noticed is a little risk for the customer, but a big risk for the new roaster that doesn't have a ton of experience tasting and working with green coffee samples. So importers get a lot of coffee, and you as a startup roaster are trying to figure out what you want to get. And sometimes you may be sold on sort of the sex appeal of the coffee and the original score of it when the coffee may have gotten old or the story doesn't actually translate into the final cup. So you may end up overpaying for a coffee, and it's just not that good. And as a startup roaster, to invest a lot in a certain coffee that somebody tells you is really good could end up hurting you in terms of your ability to turn a profit, which is important.
Yeah, I would almost like an analogy that a startup roaster should almost be like a really, really snobby wine connoisseur. Like, you're trying to learn everything about that coffee possible. When was it picked? When was it shipped? How long has it been sitting there? Has it been in Grain Pro? Like, has it been taken care of? Is humidity good? When's the last time you cupped it? Can I cup it again before I buy it again? And you can be this picky when you're working with an importer. I mean, you don't want to do this every single time. Like, once you understand a relationship, they should understand that, hey, I'm looking for all of this information. But you have to push, and you have to really set your standard. And if doesn't match, like, you can be taken, you can kind of be taken advantage of. And I'm not saying that an importer will try to take advantage of you, but if you're saying, yeah, I just need a Guatemala coffee, ship it over here, and you buy it, like, they're just doing what you told them to do. It might not be that you didn't tell them exactly what you wanted, but there's risk involved there. There's also risk involved in not knowing how to roast a coffee right, because you can buy this really expensive geisha coffee if you wanted to. Geisha is a really, really prized varietal. We'll talk about it at some point.
We'll talk about it in a few weeks.
And if you're a startup roaster just trying to learn how to roast and you love Starbucks coffee, you try to roast geisha like Starbucks, it's not going to taste good. I'm fairly certain it'll not taste good. I've never dark roasted a geisha. So.
That's actually, we should do that. So and a lot of the danger actually in that lies in the fact that you can get the same cup profile with a dark roast of a much cheaper coffee that you can with dark roasting a geisha. So don't invest in that super high-priced coffee if that's not what you need to sell to your customers. I think another risk is actually transparency. So with an importer, oftentimes you'll get sort of a snippet of where the coffee comes from and the name of the farm and, you know, the altitude, but that doesn't mean you have transparency around the coffee that you're buying. So because an importer has that information doesn't mean it's all on the up and up. I mean, of course, I don't want to sell any importers short. There are some amazing importers out there, but if you're working with a lot of importers, odds are pretty good you're going to get sold short on the story at some point.
Yeah, sometimes it takes a little bit of digging, or the trader that you're working with might not be familiar with that particular farm, and so they have to pass you off to someone else who passes you off to someone else. And eventually you can find the information, but you have to be really diligent in pushing to get that information. Otherwise, you look at your labels, and you're like, well, I know it's a Guatemala coffee. I don't really know what the altitude is, so I can kind of figure this out. And it becomes a little stressful after a while. Also, it can kind of give you a sense of what the relationship is like, because if you've worked with someone enough times, they should just know intuitively, hey, this customer needs all this information before I sell this coffee. Mm. So,
and not every customer does need the information, but it's a big deal. Transparency is a big deal in the third wave specialty coffee scene. I think the final risk is that as it's not really tied to the importer so much as it is tied to the company culture of working primarily with importers is just the passion of the baristas. The story is important not just to the customer, but getting a barista to get behind the coffee who's actually the one finally selling it. You can put all sorts of effort into getting good coffee, but if you don't have something to get your baristas pumped up, you may not be able to sell the coffee as well as you could if they were really excited about what went on to get that coffee, as we say, from farm to cup.
And to put a note on the end of that, I think a lot of importers are doing a better job these days to try to get involved in with baristas and barista competitions and showing them that they're really getting involved. I think I can think just from the Midwest barista competition we were at, the Big Central, Cafe Imports was involved, Inter-American was there.
Cafe Imports was also really heavily involved in the national barista competition, and I'm sure they were at World, I just wasn't there.
Yeah, they're obviously trying to get involved with the baristas, because I realized that if those baristas are really excited about those coffees, they're probably going to ask their coffee buyers at some point, hey, why aren't you buying from these guys? They seem to really care about the coffee, because I see that kind of farm-to-cup story, except going to the importers, and they want part of it. And if you're able to do that on your own, at your own company, and bring that farm-to-cup, that's great. But
if you can do it on your own, that's great. But if you need to work with an importer in order to get the transparency in the story and you're able to accomplish that, fantastic. And yeah, Cafe Import certainly is a really great entity within our industry to help bring that along. And they've really taken the specialty coffee importing game to a high level. So at the end of the day, it really just boils down to the needs of the particular roaster. We're pushing hard to get as high of a percentage of our coffee in through direct relationships as we can, because that's how we love working, and that's sort of how we're blessed to be able to work as a larger local roaster. But we definitely value the role that importers play, and we'll continue to use them as we go forward to meet certain needs that we have. If you have things you would like us to talk about on this here podcast, things that are important to you as a coffee drinker, fellow coffee geek, let us know, because we want to oblige and talk about it for you, and we may even reach out to you. We did get an email this week from fellow Wisconsinite Edmund Marks asking actually about travel mugs, because there's a buttload of travel mugs on the market, and not all of them are of the same quality, and not all of them are going to meet your needs. So we're just going to kick this around for a second. Edmund was asking about, hey, what's going to really just help me get my manually brewed coffee to work so I can enjoy it there without having to lug around this massive retro-style green thermos? I think we can do this just by giving you, the listener, some things to watch out for when you're looking to buy a travel mug. In our cafes, we sell Clean Canteen products, which are awesome. They're double wall steel, vacuum sealed, and I just hit like three of those points. But they're just a high quality, really durable travel mug that keeps your stuff super toasty or even super cold for 5-6 hours. You can put some coffee in there 8 o'clock in the morning and pop it open again at noon, and you're still going to be running 170 degrees.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most important thing with a good travel mug is to have a material that's going to last you a while, that's non-porous, so metal, glass, porcelain's actually pretty solid as well, a little more fragile, and something with a really tight-fitting lid so you're not going to have lots of leaks along the way. The Clean Canteen that we carry, we love the things because you can put a cafe lid on it so you can drink it as you go, or you can put like this loop lid on there which seals it nice and tight, and literally you can have it sitting on your desk for 8 hours and it will still be warm, like decently warm, like 130, 140 degrees at, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon if you made it at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. It's really amazing stuff.
As some of the things that I rattled off, I would advise you to watch out for in a good way, and that's, as Christian said, the material. So he said steel, glass, porcelain. Having a to-go cup that's double-walled is going to be super helpful because you don't want the material that's in contact with your beverage in contact with the external elements, because the temperature is going to transfer much easier than if you have a layer of air separation or insulation helping to keep your beverage the temperature you started with.
Or make sure it's easy to clean, too. I'm going to speak for a lot of baristas out here. There's nothing that grosses us out more than a really nasty travel mug.
Yeah.
Make sure it's clean. Like, we'll clean it out for you. We're cool with that. Like, if you're getting the car, no worries. Just let us know. But, you know, scrub it out every once in a while. Like, that stuff, the fond, it's not like cooking French food. The fond doesn't taste good.
Sometimes we'll visit other people's cafes, and we can taste immediately if the AirPods, which is basically a big thermos, we can taste whether or not they've been cleaned out very well. It's amazing how much a clean mug will help preserve the original flavor of your coffee. So yeah, easy to clean is a big one. Things I would watch out for is plastic. Plastic on your lid is okay-ish if you have a really good seal, but plastic does not insulate very well.
It also tends to taste weird after a while, like stuff you put in plastic cups. And I know I've had some silicone, like, tops on stuff, too, and that makes my coffee taste a little funky, too.
Keep Cup is actually great. They have some glass Keep Cups, which are amazing. Nice, small, to-go cup. If you're, you know, somebody who's up for a cappuccino or an 8-ounce latte and you don't want something really big. But I would recommend the glass ones over the plastic ones for sure.
I'll put a disclaimer out. It was my fault that the Keep Cup started tasting funny because I left it in my car for too long. Not Keep Cup's fault. However, I don't like going and buying multiple plastic cups. So buy solid material, stainless steel, glass, porcelain, double-walled if you can. We'll keep your stuff nice and toasty.
If you are in the mood for a more makeshift to-go option, Christian has got your hookup.
Yeah, for those of you who want to release your inner hipster and drink everything out of a mason jar, there's a company called Cup Pow, that's C-U-P-P-O-W, that has a lid that actually fits on top of a normal size mason jar. You screw on the lid and you screw on the metal outside ring on top of this, and you have your own travel mason jar.
Mason jars have also been equipped with all sorts of cool koozies. You can buy felt koozies, or I saw on Kickstarter a while back a company starting up called Holdster, H-O-L-D-S-T-E-R, and I've seen several other iterations of this product. It's a leather koozie with a handle sewn on, that you can put your mason jar in. So if you're feeling artsy, if you're feeling conservative in the way you approach the materials you have lying around your house, consider using a mason jar. Not great for insulation, though.
The other thing that you might want to think about, if you own a travel mug, more often than not, you get a discount from a coffee roaster when you go and fill up. At Stone Creek, we give a discount for anyone who brings in their own cup, because that's one less cup that we have to use. And I'm pretty sure that's pretty much the way it is across the industry. So, yeah, bring in your own travel mug. It's worth it.
Just make sure it's clean.
Yeah.
All right, next time, 2 weeks from now, we're going to tackle a pretty popular subject, but one that probably doesn't get enough airtime in the specialty coffee industry. Starbucks puts millions and millions of dollars into the marketing campaign around their pumpkin spice latte every year because it's such a big deal. And at Stone Creek, we've kind of embraced the pumpkin spice fanfare.
We've gotten on the pumpkin spice train.
Yeah. Yes. Because it tastes delicious if you do it right. And this year we really put some effort into doing it right. We want to talk about the phenomenon that is pumpkin spice and then the spin we put on it this year. Should be a pretty fun episode. So you can check back with us in 2 weeks. We'll have that for you. In the meantime, tweet at us, email podcast@stonecreekcoffee.com. Any questions you have, we'll either talk about it or we'll hit you back via email. Till next time, we're geeks.
And we are talking coffee.